Talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility, but the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
The Ramadan crescent moon has been sighted in Iran, and this means the fasting month begins on Wednesday. During the holy month, Muslims abstain from eating and drinking from dawn to dusk as a means to practice self-restraint. In Iran, restaurants close during the day and instead work longer hours overnight. This is especially the case for confectionaries, where they add these special sweets to their shelves every year in Ramadan.
Iranians usually break their fast by eating sweet and energetic foods. So every year in Ramadan, we bake zulbiyan baklava because they refresh the body after hours of fasting. You can find them in every Iranian confectionery during Ramadan.
This is the second year in a row that Muslims observe the fasting month amid the coronavirus pandemic. With Iran now under a partial nationwide lockdown, religious authorities have ordered that all mass religious ceremonies be either canceled or held in open-air environments with social distancing.
I pray to God to help us overcome the coronavirus. Unfortunately, this year, as in the previous Ramadan, the pandemic has kept us from gathering together to practice the Ramadan rituals.
Ramadan has always been a chance to take part in charity works, and now that the pandemic has unemployed many people, Muslims feel bound to rush for help.
During Ramadan, charity institutes ramp up their activities. This year, many people have lost their income as a result of the pandemic, so more families depend on donations to be able to break their fast.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the lunar calendar, where months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the earth. At the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. Some Muslim nations, such as Iraq and Lebanon, started the fasting month a day ahead of Iran.
To Muslims, Ramadan is more than just a time to abstain from eating and drinking. They find it an opportunity to purify the soul from materialistic desires and polish it with spirituality. This year, they use the occasion as a chance to ask God to make it the last Ramadan that is marked with the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top infectious disease expert in the U.S., admitted in an interview with The Guardian recently that major shortages of masks, gloves, and other personal protective equipment under the Trump administration contributed to the death of more than 3,600 healthcare workers during the first year of the coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Fauci Admits PPE Shortages Under Trump Increased COVID Death Toll of Frontline Healthcare Workers. Stay tuned for more. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top infectious disease expert in the U.S., admitted in an interview with The Guardian recently that major shortages of masks, gloves, and other personal protective equipment under the Trump administration contributed to the death of more than 3,600 healthcare workers during the first year of the coronavirus pandemic. During the critical times when there were shortages was when people had to use whatever was available to them. I'm sure that increased the risk of getting infected among healthcare providers, said Fauci, who served as director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases under former President Donald Trump and remains in that role under President Joe Biden. We rightfully refer to these people without hyperbole, that they are true heroes and heroines, Fauci said of healthcare workers who continue to put their health and lives at risk on the front lines of the deadly pandemic. According to a year-long joint investigation by Kaiser Health News and The Guardian, more than 3,600 healthcare workers died of COVID-19 during the first 12 months of the crisis, with lower-paid workers such as nurses, nursing home employees, and support staff far more likely to lose their lives than physicians. Many of these deaths could have been prevented, the outlets noted. Widespread shortages of masks and other personal protective gear, a lack of COVID testing, weak contact tracing, inconsistent mask guidance by politicians, missteps by employers, and lax enforcement of workplace safety rules by government regulators all contributed to the increased risk faced by healthcare workers. Despite widespread calls to take swift and decisive action, Trump dragged his feet in invoking the Defense Production Act, DPA, to facilitate mass production of PPE during the early months of the pandemic, a failure that forced many healthcare workers to reuse masks, go without gloves, and wear trash bags as gowns. One nurse said during a protest outside the White House last April, "I think that right now people think of us as heroes, but we're feeling like martyrs. We're feeling like we're being left on the battlefield with nothing." While healthcare worker deaths have slowed since coronavirus vaccines were made available in December, KHN and The Guardian counted more than 400 healthcare worker deaths since the vaccine rollout began, a signal that more needs to be done to ensure frontline employees are adequately protected. In total, the U.S. has reported nearly 31 million coronavirus cases and more than 558,000 deaths. Nobody chooses to go to work and die, said Mary Jane Appfagan, the mother of a Texas resident who lost her life to COVID-19 in September. We need to be more prepared, and the government needs to be more responsible in terms of keeping healthcare workers safe. More than 3,600 U.S. healthcare workers perished in the first year of the pandemic, according to The Last on the Frontline, a 12-month investigation by The Guardian and KHN to track such deaths. Last on the Frontline is the most complete accounting of U.S. healthcare worker deaths. The federal government has not comprehensively tracked this data, but calls are mounting for the Biden administration to undertake a count as the KHN Guardian project comes to a close today. The project, which tracked who died and why, provides a window into the workings and failings of the U.S. healthcare system during the COVID-19 pandemic. One key finding is that two-thirds of diseased healthcare workers, for whom the project has data identified as people of color, revealing the deep inequities tied to race, ethnicity, and economic status in America's healthcare workforce. Lower-paid workers who handled everyday patient care, including nurses, support staff, and nursing home employees, were far more likely to die in the pandemic than physicians were. The year-long series of investigative reports found that many of these deaths could have been prevented. Widespread shortages of masks and other personal protective gear, a lack of COVID testing, weak contact tracing, inconsistent mask guidance by politicians, missteps by employers, and lax enforcement of workplace safety rules by government regulators all contributed to the increased risk faced by healthcare workers. Studies show that healthcare workers were more than three times as likely to contract COVID as the general public.
Who Rules America?
Part 6.
No series about Who Rules America can leave out Wall Street's financial clout. We've left its impact for last, secure in the knowledge that in today's America, this financial district is a key power center, a hub for the financialization of an economy in which the control of big money is often central to the control of politics and society. We have spoken with a respected corporate executive who told us point blank that the rich now rule America.
My personal opinion is a large part of what's happening economically is due to basically globalization and digitization of business. That can't be stopped.
Professor Stanley Aronowitz quotes the famous sociologist C. Wright Mills on the same theme from 50 years ago.
Wall Street, the financial sector, is the leading edge of corporate capital. And it was the leading edge of corporate capital in the mid-50s. Of course, today it's much more accentuated because of the relative decline of industrial corporations.
Many Americans see all this as a conspiracy by an unaccountable secret cabal that operates like a power center beyond democratic control. The internet is filled with videos about shadowy billionaires and their plots that control everything.
Which is ongoing right now. It is a conspiracy of institutional corruption from the highest level.
From international bankers to the super rich, from Washington to Rome, they're all in it together.
And when is Wall Street a conspiracy? And what role does it play in Who Rules America? Is it an outside job or an inside job?
It's not a matter of elites outside the state, although, of course, they have enormous influence. But the reason they have enormous influence is because the state is structured to be reproducing their power and authority in the society.
Leo Panitch, he's an economist and analyst, and I think he offered a perspective that we really haven't heard before. He's sort of fighting against the conspiratorial idea, you know, that there's a small group of people in a room somewhere running things. He's talking about the structure of the society, the values of it, who really runs things.
Wall Street is not only a place, it's an industry with thousands of interconnected firms that call themselves a financial services industry. But they are much more than that. They are deeply involved with how our country is run, says Robert Weissman, the head of the public interest group, Public Citizen.
Well, you can't understand what's happened in the country in the last 30 years in terms of economic policy and really the way the country's evolved politically without understanding how Wall Street has grown in power. It's grown in economic power, and it's grown in political power, and that's been synergistic. They use their political power to wipe out a whole range of regulations that control them.
In the past, investors would buy stocks in real companies and industries that generated jobs, provided services, or created products of value. Those days are gone.
They became a bigger and bigger portion of the economy.
Then we went from an economy of production, making things, to one based on consumption, buying and selling things. Consumers soon drove 70% of the economy as banks, private equity companies, and hedge funds grew in size.
As they became a bigger portion of the economy, they were able to leverage more and more political power in a really horrible cycle for the functioning of democracy. And what that led us up to, of course, was the crash in 2008.
So consumers went deeper and deeper into debt. And then bankers bought and sold debt while they changed the rules regulating their activities.
A whole series of deregulatory moves that had been enabled by the influence, the political influence of Wall Street, led to the actual functioning of the economy to be a disaster.
Because, as billionaire investor George Soros told me years ago, the capitalist economy is also inherently unstable and prone to bubbles and crashes.
I've worked with the theory that financial markets are inherently unstable. And to prevent excesses, you need some kind of intervention, supervision, regulation. Unfortunately, the prevailing idea is that markets tend towards equilibrium. And so we work with a false concept of how financial markets operate.
We were told by someone, for example, that the beauty of globalization is that no one is in control.
Well, there is a great advantage in that because controls have their own problems. In fact, markets are much more efficient than centralized controls. But it doesn't mean that there should be absolutely no control. And in fact, if you look at reality, ever since you've had capitalism and ever since you've had financial markets, you have had crises. And each time there was a crisis, there was something done to prevent a recurrence.
The problem this time is the dramatic surge in debt, chart showing the debt of the United States, page after page, illustrating how much money is owed. It's mind-boggling. It gets even more complicated when you start talking about new financial instruments like derivatives that have turned the industry into a global casino. Derivatives can also be used as insurance, betting that a loan will or won't default before a given date. They become the basis of a big betting system, like in a casino. Financial journalist Max Keiser says just a handful of big financial firms now dominate the industry and the global economy.
Without a doubt, there's J.P. Morgan, which is in bed with the Fed and the central banking system.
Wall Street bets on future values and the performance of practically everything of value.
So you've got Morgan, Goldman Sachs are the two primary players in this global financialized world.
Soon, CEOs, financiers, and executives of a small number of investment banks and hedge funds became rich and powerful by controlling specialized high-stakes markets.
They are connected to the central banking system, which is the Fed, the ECB. The Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland is kind of the central bank of the central banks. And these are the folks that are keeping, their main purpose at this point is to keep interest rates as close to zero as possible, to make it as cheap as possible for people who are borrowing money to speculate, to be able to speculate freely without having to pay for the money that they're borrowing to speculate.
Even if these financial markets are supposedly open to all, a relatively few traders, investors, and asset managers came to structure the markets to increase their own wealth and power.
And if they ever make a bad bet, then they quickly move to cover their bad bets with austerity programs or some kind of bailout program or a quantitative easing program.
A Swiss study by physicists on the ownership and control of stock exchanges in 48 countries examined 24,877 stocks and 106,141 shareholding entities. To their amazement, they found that just 10 companies were dominating all stock ownership. Here they are.
When we talk about money and we talk about Wall Street, we have to ask this question: where does the money come from that's used in the speculation in our financial markets? This man knows, Barry James Dyke. He's an asset manager and he works with clients. So where does it come from?
The money comes from people's savings, regular old savings, people's retirement funds, which is saving for retirement.
But do the people who put their money into these accounts know how it's being invested or spent?
They don't have a clue.
It's only now, as a result of the financial crisis, that the public is learning slowly that the self-styled masters of the universe on Wall Street speculated on risky investments and created a crash. Graydon Carter, the editor of Vanity Fair, wrote, "It can fairly be said that the chain of catastrophic bets made over the past decade by a few hundred bankers may well turn out to be the greatest nonviolent crime against humanity in history. They brought the world's economy to its knees, lost tens of millions of people their jobs and their homes, and crashed the retirement plans of a generation. And they could drive an estimated 200 million people worldwide into dire poverty."
We are trying to recover from a financial crisis that some people say is even worse than the Depression in the 1930s. And yet, reforms that have been proposed, very modest reforms, are being fought tooth and nail at the regulatory level by Wall Street firms and financiers. Do you think that they have a disproportionate power to influence Congress?
There's no doubt about that. Not just the Congress, but state legislatures as well. Their strength, their power, runs the entire gambit of the American political system.
I read that the financial services industry had hired 28 lobbyists per member of Congress to try to influence their decisions, to try to inform. What happens to you when lobbyists come into your office to try to get you to vote their way? How does that work, that game?
Well, it's very hard to get a meeting with me. I don't think that they spent a lot of money trying to lobby me. I'm kind of clear on my ideology, clear on my view of representative government, and very clear on the Constitution. But suffice it to say, while my district is competitive, there are many more competitive districts than mine. And every member of Congress, to that extent, becomes a prisoner to the election process, to the fundraising process.
Sheila Krumholz of the Center for Responsive Politics says Wall Street's power is well documented.
Wall Street, the banks, and the financial industry writ large is the single largest source of campaign cash in the United States, and it has been for years, if not decades. It is kind of following the Willie Sutton rule of politics. You go where the money is. That's where the money is. They have not just political action committees that can pony up maximum amounts to influential members of Congress who have jurisdiction over their industry, but also they can pony up, pass the hat and pony up hundreds of thousands of dollars just among their partners and vice presidents and executives in their companies.
She says their clout will impact the election in 2012.
So they can muster a ton of money. And this is also seen specifically in the presidential race in 2012, where, of course, Mitt Romney has hailed from the private equity industry. And prior to that, Barack Obama had been the darling of Wall Street. So Wall Street and banks in particular are an enormously influential part of the U.S. Industry.
That power is being shown as Wall Street lobbyists try to sabotage financial reforms passed by Congress.
2 years after the passage of the legislation, and are the regulators doing the good things that Congress told them to do? And the answer to a considerable extent is no. They're way behind on issuing the rules that they're supposed to issue. Where they actually have issued the rules, they're getting challenged in almost every instance in court by the Chamber of Commerce or the Financial Securities Roundtable or other Wall Street interests. And they're having a tough time with a judiciary that's favorable to big business and maintaining the rules that they've issued.
So reforms can be passed, but they can also be sabotaged.
Right. They get multiple bites at the apple. They get a bite in Congress, where they've got enormous power, but at least it's mostly a public fight. And then they go to the regulatory agencies, where they also have enormous power, but it's usually below the radar, off the front pages, and they don't even have the public scrutiny.
Recently, on a radio show I host, I discussed Wall Street power and the financial meltdown with financial journalists Max Keiser and Stacey Herbert, as well as Andy Stepanian, an animal rights activist who led a campaign against a company in the business of painful medical tests on puppies. After his group drove their stock price down, the company went broke, but then the government labeled him a financial terrorist and sent him to prison. We began by comparing Wall Street to the Titanic, the unsinkable ship that sank.
If the Titanic were the story today, the difference would be that Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan would have heavy bets that would pay off when the ship sinks, and Hank Paulson would be down there widening the gash.
It brings me to a new study out just recently, and they looked at hundreds of shipwrecks throughout the past few hundred years. What they found is that the norm is actually for women and children to die more frequently than men, and that the captain usually didn't go down with the ship. They were usually their survival rate was the highest.
These guys, they use derivatives, as Warren Buffett calls them, weapons of mass financial destruction, to make situations worse, because their bets that they have on these calamities becoming worse pay off enormously, and we see that in the numbers, in the bonuses. It's reflected.
Andy, you were nodding before when Max was speaking about all of this. Is this really true that they're betting against, you know, us, in a sense, betting against, you know, hoping for bad things to happen?
I don't think that everybody that works on Wall Street has this mentality, but there is a culture that's in place where people have learned to at least accept and justify behavior like looking at these investments, betting investments against, you know, things to fail, whether it be a government, whether it be a country, or whether it be a company to fail, and say, oh, well, I can justify this. And you look at it like it's numbers. You don't look at the people behind it. You don't look at the families that suffer. You don't look at the country that suffers as a result.
Well, here's what you know, is mind-boggling to me. Is you are presenting a picture of intentionality, that people did things to further their own interests. They knew what they were doing. It was calculated. And yet, in most of the media, it seems as if it's presented as some sort of mistake, as miscalculation. Gee, we wanted housing to go up, but it went down. You can't blame us. Everybody was doing it. Therefore, nobody was doing it. Therefore, nobody can be prosecuted.
Well, let's assume that there was intention. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Some would argue that it's a good thing to have people who are parasites in an economy, because parasites are useful. I have parasites in my intestines. They perform a useful function. The problem is the parasites don't run my heart, lungs, and brain. In America, the parasites write the regulatory framework that's supposed to be governing them, so the parasites run the show.
Is Wall Street affecting, you know, capital? Is Wall Street affecting our policymaking? Well, they're becoming our policymakers, at least for a short period of time, and then returning back to the banks.
So it's a revolving door kind of thing.
Essentially. I mean, they're in and out of whether it be the Bush administration or the Obama administration, the different positions within the cabinet that are, you know, governing finance are individuals that are former CEOs of banks, or they might go back to being an honorary chair on the board of directors. It's this incestuous relationship between Wall Street and policymakers.
Sounds so corrupt.
Danny, you asked who runs America, and I say it's ignorance. And, you know, Thomas Jefferson warned of this, and that we needed a media who would inform the population, otherwise we would lose our democracy. So this is ignorance that is being forced upon you, criminalizing knowledge.
This is something that I was startled by when NASDAQ opened up, you know, in Times Square, a big studio out front with a big window. And, you know, and then I said, I'd love to tour the exchange. And, you know, this was the time that Bernie Madoff was running NASDAQ, you know, and they said, you can't tour the exchange. There is no exchange. It looks like an exchange. There's a building that says NASDAQ, but the actual operations are computers.
Algorithmic trading goes well beyond that, as you're alluding to. It's not about individuals who are taking any risks personally to make a market as part of a capitalist system. These are computers that have virtually unlimited credit because the cost of credit is now zero. And the ability for a bank like J.P. Morgan with a $90 trillion balance sheet of derivatives, they can lend $1 trillion to a computer program to make a bet. If the bet doesn't work, then they get a federal bailout. If the bet works, then they get a bonus. So it's heads they win, tails we lose. And this has been going on now for a number of years, but it's gotten shockingly more disproportionate and asymmetric.
This shift towards super-fast computers is just another example of the deeper shift we've seen in power as finance, in effect, takes over, with politicians courting Wall Street at global conferences and in private meetings, as George Soros explains.
It is actually symptomatic of the age, because you have presidents and prime ministers courting the financiers and the industrialists. So it does show a shift in the relative power. But I don't want to convey. See, I don't believe that business can in any way replace the power of the state, because it's a different kind of power. So the sovereignty is still in the hands of the state.
Wall Street, you know, it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but Wall Street controls everything, you know. I mean, they're the major shareholders of all the major companies. Look at the BP oil spill. Who is the owner of BP oil spill? The biggest shareholder is J.P. Morgan. There's so much happening now, you know. There's no stopping what's happening now. The system, everyone knows the system's broken, whether you're a 1%er or a 99%er, a Republican, a Democrat, anarchist, communist, capitalist. Everyone knows the system is broken. So now we need to fix it.
We'll give the last word to a scholar with a longer view, American historian Eric Foner.
I think what we face is a serious democracy deficit, not only in the United States, but in many other countries as well. I'm not quite ready to say a plutocracy determines everything that happens in the United States, but I think the democracy deficit arises from the fact that fundamental issues are now just off limits from democracy. It doesn't matter who is elected. The basic issues about finance, about deindustrialization, things like that, are about globalization, about the loss of power of ordinary people over their own lives. That's not open to discussion. The fundamental issues facing ordinary people are not subject to democratic consideration. Government does not represent the ordinary people. Even though people elect the government does not respond at all to the needs and aspirations of ordinary people.
In this series, we've investigated who rules America, examining the history of deep conflicts in this country going back to the American Revolution. We've dissected the power of the military, corporations, the media, and Wall Street. We have shown that these powerful forces often undermine democracy rather than strengthen it. There is a battle underway for the soul of America, for who rules America, that has put these deeper issues on the agenda. The question, is a fundamental transformation possible, or will special interests and the wealthiest Americans continue to dominate in a country that says it's the most dynamic democracy on earth?
The belief in our democracy is almost an article of religious faith.
even though there's a separation of church and state. Perhaps that's why the views you've heard in this series are rejected by the establishment, rejected by academia, rejected by the press. They believe only the people have power, if anyone does. But opinion leaders don't look into it. They don't focus on interests. They focus on ideologies, on personalities, not institutions. The idea of a power elite is an anathema to them, because if people believed it, that might spur dissatisfaction and dissent. In the age of the internet and global television, you can't stop people from being exposed to counter-narratives to official myths. These issues are debatable, of course, but most political coverage doesn't debate other ways of looking at the world. It relies on the usual pundits recycling conventional wisdom. They don't ask, who rules America?
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
The limelight.
There is vast support across the U.S. for defunding police departments and shifting funding to nonviolent alternatives to policing. A Data for Progress poll published earlier this month, for example, found that 65% of voters in the U.S. would support reallocating some of law enforcement budgets to support such non-police first responder programs. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Residents of Minneapolis Suburb Rise Up Against Police Killing of Don't Write. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Following the police perpetrated killing of a 20-year-old black man in the Twin Cities suburb of Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, hundreds of residents demonstrated outside of police headquarters and throughout the city on Sunday night, April 11th, into Monday morning, April 12th. About 200 protesters near police department headquarters chanted the name of Don't Write, who police shot to death hours earlier. Police responded to the protest against police-perpetrated violence with flashbangs and tear gas to disperse the crowd, claiming rocks were thrown at the building during the uprising. Governor Tim Walz deployed the National Guard to the area. Brooklyn Center Mayor Mike Elliott placed a curfew on the city until 6 a.m. on Monday morning, April 12th. Police reportedly pulled right over just before 2 p.m. Central Time on Sunday, April 11th in Brooklyn Center. Wright's mother told reporters that her son had called her to get information about the vehicle's insurance, as his family gave the car to Wright just 2 weeks prior. Wright's mother said her son was pulled over for having air fresheners on his rearview mirror. Police allege Wright tried to re-enter his vehicle after being confronted over an outstanding warrant. The officer then shot Wright, who drove several blocks before crashing into another vehicle. He was pronounced dead at the scene of the crash. While it is technically against state law to hang objects from the mirror of a moving car, the Minnesota branch of the American Civil Liberties Union expressed deep concerns that police here appear to have used dangling air fresheners as an excuse for making a pretextual stop, something police do all too often to target black people. During a press conference on Monday, April 12th, Brooklyn Center Police Chief Tim Gannon alleged that police perpetrated killing was accidental. As I watched the video and listened to the officer's commands, it is my belief that the officer had the intention to deploy their taser but instead shot Mr. Wright with a single bullet, Gannon said. This appears to me from what I viewed and the officer's reaction and distress immediately after that this was an accidental discharge that resulted in the tragic death of Mr. Wright. Many on social media did not accept that rationale as acceptable. Ben Passer, lead director of Energy Access and Equity at the Minnesota-based clean energy nonprofit Fresh Energy, opined on the matter, saying that Wright's killing being an accident doesn't make it any better. The power to end the life shouldn't rest in the hands of a single officer's careless decision. An accident shouldn't result in the loss of life, Passer said. Simon Balto, a professor of black studies at the University of Iowa, noted the significance of the police-perpetrated killing taking place during the ongoing trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who killed George Floyd last year after kneeling on his neck for several minutes. Don't Wright was killed in the Twin Cities for the same reason that George Floyd was killed in the Twin Cities. Because the first language of police and the organizing principle of policing is violence, and because white supremacy is a structuring element of the whole system, Balto said on Twitter. There is vast support across the country for defunding police departments and shifting funding to nonviolent alternatives to policing. A Data for Progress poll published earlier this month, for example, found that 65% of voters in the U.S. would support reallocating some of law enforcement budgets to support such non-police first responder programs. Support for such measures reaches across partisan lines, with majorities of Democratic and Republican-leaning respondents in the poll backing the idea of reallocating police funding towards such programs. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing The Land of the Enlightened, directed by Belgian photographer Pieter-Jan Depuis. And joining me in this episode are Kalim Aftab, who is a film critic and freelance writer who writes for the independent newspaper primarily. And beside him, we are also joined by Jonathan Steele, who is a veteran foreign correspondent and author of widely acclaimed studies of international relations. He is also the author of Ghosts of Afghanistan, The Haunted Battleground. Now, this film captures Afghanistan's legacy of invasion, war, and conflict. The Land of the Enlightened is a docudrama that strives for a dreamlike reality to convey the fundamental divergence in worldviews between the US occupiers and the ethnic groups that have inhabited the region for millennia. Combining narrative and non-fiction techniques, the documentary's initial scenes present the first of many spectacular panoramas of Afghanistan's dramatic landscapes, while also following the operating base defended by US and Afghan soldiers who are attempting to neutralize Taliban advances on the periphery of the zone controlled by coalition forces. First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, I thought the documentary offered a great vantage point into the power vacuum of the war-torn country that is Afghanistan. And also, it focuses on a group of Afghan children who act as a gang and collect opium and other valuables and seem to trade them and live in parallel with the US soldiers. Kalim, if I could turn to you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this documentary?
Well, first off, I think the first impression is the cinematography is so luscious and beautiful. The director used to be a photographer, so it's no surprise he has an eye for that. And then what we find is this documentary that I found was very beautiful, and the kids were amazing. But there was some strange stuff going on. The voiceover was in a different voice that was presumably Nasser to the Nasser we see on screen. So it has this dreamlike quality where we're not quite sure what's going on as we're watching it, and it plays out as vignettes rather than as a very strong narrative.
That's another interesting point to make, and it's very arty, I suppose, the feel of the documentary. And Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what's your impression of this film?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's a very romantic film in terms of the use of landscape, the snow, the caravans, the camels, and these kids rushing around. But it is a little bit simplifying and not entirely accurate. When it ends, that trailer saying the Afghans are still waiting for their king, I think that's not true anymore. Mm-hmm. People now in a much more modern kind of society, half the country living in urban situations, they're not in these beautiful, remote, windswept landscapes anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's become a much more modern country than the film shows, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps you could shed more light on the political context, actually, of this film. And Kalim, I'd like to ask you, actually, this film won an award at the Sundance Film Festival for cinematography. And I suppose it's refreshing to see these landscapes and scenes where you always think of Afghanistan as a war-torn country.
I think it's refreshing. He's taken a lead from kind of Werner Herzog, who went to Iraq and showed these beautiful, like, oil fields up in flames and made them look beautiful. And here he's gone, he's used a 16mm camera, which we don't see so much film anymore. So already that kind of luscious quality, that kind of romantic quality is there. And then with his eye as a photographer, I think it's just no surprise that him and his DP created such a beautiful looking film.
Yeah, that soft music when you talk about taking over a country without people knowing. Step one is you get the support of the locals. I'm going to trade them brass for scarves and whatnot. I figure that will stimulate their economy. They can melt it down and make IEDs out of it. Get rupees from the Pakistanis and brass from us. It'll be good. Good for everyone involved. Step number two, becoming king of Afghanistan, is once we pull out, I'm going to stay behind. I'm going to hide in a conspicuous vehicle. Something nobody has around here, maybe a white Toyota Camry wagon. There's not too many of those rolling around here. I'm gonna hide out for a little bit, and then I'm gonna grow a beard out. And I might become supreme overlord of just a province, one province at a time. I might migrate to Pakistan, cross the border a couple times. I don't know yet. But I definitely want to have an army of children because they frighten me. And I think they're like clowns. They scare people just because they're so innocent.
Just following that clip, I get the impression from watching the US soldiers that they seem to be living in a bubble there on the outpost, and I seem to get the impression also that they don't really want to be there either. I see you nodding your head there, Jonathan. Did you get that impression?
Well, I thought that was one of the best bits of the film, actually, the sort of pointlessness of the American occupation and what the hell they were doing. They didn't know themselves. And then this very naive speech that one of the officers gives to a group of Afghans who sit there completely silent. Mm-hmm. You know, you can try and read their minds, but they're saying, what is this man talking about? You know, who is he? What right has he got to be standing here? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that was really great. And then the firing, too, the Americans just blasting away at some hillside. Nobody else in sight. They couldn't see what the so-called enemy was supposed to be.
We have a clip of that, actually. We don't want to give too much away just yet, but
okay.
I won't spoil
the plot. But, you know, the pointlessness of the American occupation.
I suppose that's a symbolic message. And, Kalim, would you agree with that? What did you make of their contribution in this documentary and how they
portrayed? I really like the way that the director made a film about little groups. A little group of kids and then a group of American soldiers and the juxtaposition between the two of them. So in one scene you're watching this pointlessness, and we bring a lot of baggage to the film of what we think should be happening, and he's just saying it's mindless, but he doesn't really hammer home that point. He's just showing and tell is a good filmmaking technique. Mm.
It's a beautiful film indeed. And I just want to move on briefly now to something in the beginning of the film. It's established very on that Afghanistan, through the narration, has been a war-torn country for a long time, and it's been plagued and prone to invasion. Jonathan, if I can ask you, how accurate is this point that the documentary makes?
Well, it's in the modern times, of course, it's been at war since 1979 when the Soviet Union set its troops in there. And really, that war has continued until today. But in the medieval period, as I point out, Genghis Khan came, mm-hmm. and there was Nasrallah, the king, who was overthrown. But actually, a lot of the kids that we saw were probably the descendants of Genghis Khan. So they are the children of invaders. But this is a country that's at the crossroads of Central Asia, and so it's obviously one that many foreigners have tramped through and tried to conquer. After all, Alexander the Great, the city of Kandahar, which we all know is named after Kandahar, isn't a corruption of Alexander. Mm-hmm. He founded that city. So there have always been foreigners coming through. But I think the point that ought to be made, and isn't made well enough in the film, is that the civil war is also there. It's not just a question of kind of united Afghans against the foreigner. There's a civil war going on, and really that's what the struggle is now about. There's the Afghan army with the Americans helping them, and then there's the Taliban on the other side, and even the terrible IS, has come in to Afghanistan recently. Mm-hmm. And so it's partly foreigners coming in and partly Afghans fighting among themselves.
Mm-hmm. So it's an incredibly complex issue, Afghanistan, and you can't explain it all in one film. So I suppose maybe there'll be a second part to this. I was worried that the children might be there in the mountains when they were shooting. But I would like to talk actually a bit more about the children now, since they're such a central part of this film. They seem really young to be dealing with this situation and the gravity of it all. And this film suggests that actually that there's a codependent relationship, I suppose, between the children and the US soldiers, in that they are trading with the leftover ammunition, other equipment and so forth. But then it makes you think, on the other hand, actually, they wouldn't be in the situation if there wasn't an invasion in the first place. Did this message resonate with you also?
I think what resonated more was the actual image of ammunition and how ammunition had become something that it wasn't meant to be. You see the soldiers just shooting into mindlessly, asking if it's an internet game, which is very true. But with the kids, they're bartering with the ammunition. They're also using it to weigh opium at one stage. It's become something that's so everyday, but it's not actually about the ammunition. It's not about the war. It's about this, as you say, codependency. And he shows that in a way without overbearing the point, which I like, but ammunition is a big key part of this film. Mm.
And also, Jonathan, I just want to get your views, actually. What do you make of this sort of fight for survival for these children and the way that they have to depend on these US ammunition to get by?
Well, that's what made me feel I wasn't sure how realistic it was, really. I mean, let's face it, child soldiers, and it's terrible that children are put in this position. We see nothing about their families apart from one boy who wants to marry the girl. foot next door, as it were, and has to ask the father always give her permission. But apart from that, there's no sense of families or what the parents think about it. Do the parents want the kids to be doing this? Are these orphans? Where are they living? I mean, so that's why I thought it was over-romantic, you know, seeing these sort of kids being grown-ups already earlier before that time.
Actually, I did some research, and according to the charity Save the Children, nearly a third of all children in Afghanistan are actually unable to attend school, leaving them potentially more vulnerable, at risk of child labour and exploitation and so forth. And there's also the issue of early marriages and sort of, obviously, the drug problem, which is quite prominent in the film.
Well, there's also the unexploded ordnance, you know, so you know, the landmines. The unscrewing that scene was a scene where the boy unscrews a landmine to try and defuse it, to take it off to be sold. I mean, and the other kids are sitting around within 4 feet of him, so if the thing does blow up, you know, several kids are going to get killed. I mean, there's a real danger. A lot of children are dying of unexploded ordnance, but more by accident than because they're trying to sell it. You know, they trip on it, they think it's a toy, they pick it up, it blows up in their face. So it is a serious problem.
So there is obviously a direct connection between sort of the US invasion and foreign intervention and the risk that these children have.
Well, some of these mines, I think, may be left over from the Soviet Union. They look more like Soviet mines to me, which are used by the Mujahideen and the Taliban as well, because they've got stocks of them. So it goes back before the US occupation to the Soviet occupation.
And did you want anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's all very interesting, those scenes, because they're actually reenactments. So part of this film is documentary and part of it is reenactment. And I think those films jar, because those scenes, sorry, jar, because they are reenactments and we're watching little children act. And you can see them act sometimes. It doesn't feel as natural as some other bits of the movie.
All right. Thank you very much for those points. There's some brilliant cinematic scenes there, especially for a documentary. Now we're just in the final part of the discussion about this film. And I just wanted to ask you, Kaleem, that some of the criticisms of this film is that it doesn't follow a classical narrative structure. But then perhaps one could argue that actually that this reflects a lot of reality because the war itself didn't have a narrative.
Yeah, I think the film has a lot of vignettes, as I said previously, and it shows the groups. And he wants it to have a documentary feel in terms of the structure, in terms of, oh, I've just managed to catch this by accident. But he falls down a little bit because he has reenactments, and that jars with that. And then also you see scenes like the helicopters flying, and it makes you think of narratives like Apocalypse Now and Platoon, and it takes you away from the documentary feel. So I think that, in a little way, which I really liked about it because it made it feel like a dream, but it moved it to a heightened reality. And I can see why that's a problem for a lot of people.
But perhaps, actually, I was just thinking it will draw in sort of political people and non-political also in sort of terms of a compromise. But just to talk about more about the politics of the situation, earlier on in the film, actually, also talked about, it mentioned Obama reporting that there'd be 9,800 or so more troops that will remain after 2014, which is when combat operations formally ended. But then in late 2017, President Trump announced that he wanted to send an additional 3,000 troops to the country. I mean, what do you think the plan is for the US in Afghanistan?
Well, if I can just add to one point that was made earlier, I was talking about how the Soviet occupation preceded the Afghan, the American one. That clip we've just seen of the helicopters, the poem that was being said and being sung, was actually Russian. It comes from the Afghansi, as they were called, the Soviet troops in Afghanistan. So it was clever of the director to merge the two, although perhaps he should have explained it a bit more, that these people were actually singing in Russian.
There's some subliminal messages there. Perhaps.
More messages. But coming on to what you said, yes, there are now today 14,000 American troops in Afghanistan, and Obama had hoped to bring them out all together by the time he packed up as president a year and a bit ago. So it's an open-ended war. It's a quagmire. It's a pit, you know, in which they've fallen and they can't get out of. But the worst thing is really the Afghan troops. I said it was a civil war. The Afghan troops are also fighting. It's not just the Americans. They're losing something like 20 soldiers a day, more than 8,000 a year. If you think that the Americans themselves only lost 2,400 in 15 years, and the Afghans are losing 8,000 a year, the rate of attrition is colossal, which is why there's massive desertion. People don't sign up again, and they try and avoid being conscripted, and it's a terrible, terrible situation.
Terrible indeed. I wish we could talk more, actually, because there's just so much to talk about. But actually, I just wanted